Okay, as we begin this now, tape 5 in Family-Based Youth Ministry course, this is Side A. The title of this lecture, remember, is Walking the Tightrope. We're going to talk about Family-Based Youth Ministry and the developmental need for independence. A few thoughts before we get started. These words from a teenager quoted in Kevin Lehman's Smart Kids, Stupid Choices. Excuse me, but if my parents like this shirt, can I return it? Robert Coles, in his book Sex and the American Teenager, writes this. Years of work with adolescents persuade me that they are the last ones in the world to want freedom, a sense of privacy, and autonomy that deprives them of the advice and counsel, the warm support and understanding of their parents, and for that matter, of others, teachers and doctors, who are older and might have a good deal to say about some of the difficulties that confront a person of 15, 16, or 17. Stephen Covey, in 7 Habits of Highly Effective People, says, interdependence is a higher value than independence. And then this great picture of adolescence from Frederick Buechner in his book Whistling in the Dark. The ancient Druids are said to have taken special interest in in-between things like mistletoe, which is neither quite a plant nor quite a tree, and in mist, which is neither quite rain nor quite air. They believed that such things as those were able to, that in such things as those, they were able to glimpse the mystery of two worlds at once. Adolescents can have the same glimpse by looking in the full-length mirror on the back of the bathroom door. And then a teenager quoted in Children of Fast-Track Parents. This teenager said, but you want so much to do something for yourself, by yourself, without your parents being involved, even if it's selling used cars. A part of what you want to be, a part of you wants to be totally different than your parents, but another part wants to be just like them. And then C.S. Lewis, in one of his essays, says, mere change is growth. Growth is the synthesis of change and continuity. And where there is not continuity, there is no growth. In my last year of seminary, I chose to focus my study in the area of youth evangelism. And since there were no youth evangelism courses at my school, in many ways I had to start from scratch. I wound up writing to over 100 professors, youth ministry organizations, denominational youth ministry offices, looking for leads or for information. Responses varied widely. Organizations like Young Life and Youth for Christ were particularly helpful. They sent extensive materials used primarily in their staff training. Ironically, others wrote back simply to say they didn't have time to respond to requests like mine. I did wonder where they found the time to write me the note that told me they didn't have time to write me the note. But by far the most interesting response I received was from the director of a national youth ministry office in my own denomination. He wrote, we are drawing the line and saying in such areas as evangelism, it is high time that youth be significantly incorporated into the overall, I would add in parentheses, adult program, and that there not be a special youth evangelism program. Now, it may seem odd to you that throughout this book, I've argued that youth need to be incorporated into the total life of the church. And I certainly have no problem with that, with the perspective of incorporating youth into the total life of the church. What I do question is what this denominational executive suggested as significant incorporation. He said, we think it is time that youth be significantly incorporated into the overall program of the church. Well, that executive's letter contains a noble sentiment. Teenagers should be incorporated into the church beyond its youth ministry. Absolutely. But it doesn't take a rocket scientist to estimate how many teenagers actually have been significantly incorporated into the church's evangelism program through this particular kind of strategy. I would be so bold as to say that this kind of incorporation never happens unless adults intentionally plan for it. Do you see the difference between what I've been arguing in family-based youth ministry and what this letter from this executive argued? I've been arguing that we need to intentionally incorporate our kids in the life of the church. And this, there's one, there's a significant difference. Instead of using the word intentional, he used the word significantly incorporated. Well, I would agree they need to be significantly incorporated, but unless we have a unique strategy for that incorporation, it's not going to happen by and large. As Mark Center's research highlights, a survey of the history of youth ministry shows that the evangelization of high school students, if left to peers, will never get done. Adults have consistently had to structure situations, train student evangelists, and hold young people accountable to do the job. One church has designed its entire youth ministry around the no intentional plan philosophy. At this church, little or no money is budgeted for youth ministry, except, of course, to buy the denominational Sunday school curriculum. The adults in the church throw up their hands when they talk about kids these days and are mystified to discover that so few of them show up for church. The minister and the church officers are particularly shocked and embarrassed to discover that their own children would rather go to Young Life than to the church. What is this church doing right? Well, instead of isolating the youth into their own group, the church has expected young people to be incorporated into the life of the total church. But in their zeal for providing continuity and tradition for their teenagers, this church has neglected another equally important need, the adolescent need for individuation. Let's talk about another church. A second church's youth ministry is at the other end of the spectrum. This church has an active group of teenagers who are so distinct from the church that a casual observer would hardly recognize that they were anywhere close to the same family. The teenagers love being together and they boast of quite significant numbers. Quite frankly, the church loves having so many visible teenagers. So when they break rules on trips to the church, the leadership has a habit of looking the other way. The classic response from the adults in the church is, let's not do anything that might make them leave. Wherever this church goes, their reputation follows. They've done damage at hotels and retreat centers, performed dangerous initiations, and learned to scoff at the rules other groups are expected to obey. This church has given its teenagers wonderful opportunities to individuate, separate from the tradition they've received. But they've been robbed of the continuity and accountability that comes from being connected to the community of faith. Now, at this point, you may be scratching your head. You may be saying, wait a second, which one are you advocating? Well, let's talk about what do teenagers really need. One of the dads in our church hit the nail on the head when he described his 15-year-old son as sometimes 20 and sometimes 4. Teenagers frustrate us because they're caught somewhere in between, childhood and adulthood. And often they seem to be saying and showing that they need two very different things at the same time. And you know what? They do. If we design our ministries based exclusively on the express needs of our youth, we will have set ourselves up for frustration. Most, if not all, youth ministers have had the experience of asking a group of teenagers what they wanted to do, only to find out after hours of preparation that the very ones who passionately pushed for the event decided not to come. So rather than depending primarily on teenagers' perceptions of what they need and want, it is our role as adults to know what their primary needs are and to create programs that will be responsive to those needs. So what then do teenagers need in order to grow toward mature Christian adulthood? Teenagers seem to have a paradoxical task in faith development. On the one hand, they need continuity with tradition, a faith community to be nurtured in. But on the other hand, they need to step away from their inherited tradition and develop a faith of their own. Not their mother's faith, the pastor's faith, or their best friend's faith. These two tasks often seem to pull against each other. But unless we address both of these needs, our youth ministries, again, will be limited in their long-term effectiveness. We're going to talk first about the need for continuity, because I want to be clear that I'm still saying we've got to provide the same sort of things I've been talking about through the entire course. Let's talk about continuity, then we're going to talk about the need for individuation. Those are the two kinds of needs that kids have. Quite honestly, the most successful youth ministries do a much better job at addressing the need for individuation than the need for continuity. Many youth workers revel in the fact that they're always in trouble for something, always questioning the status quo, although in most places, teenagers really don't need much help in rejecting the status quo. Johnny grew up in a youth group that was lacking in continuity. He hit our youth group running when he was in the seventh grade. Intense was the word we often used for him. Wherever the group was, Johnny was usually right in the middle of it. He was a working machine on mission trips. He prayed with a passion. He sang worship songs with a serious spiritual intensity that I was thrilled to have in our group. I can still picture him in the back of the room at one of our, we call them afterglow gatherings after Sunday night church, with his eyes closed tightly in worship. Johnny was a model of following Christ for others in our youth group. But as the years passed and he graduated from high school and college, he began to understand his earlier intense spiritual experiences as something he did when he was young. Although he still attends the same church sporadically today, exactly what Johnny's parents did as he was growing up, he's lost the spiritual vibrancy that was so contagious when he was a teenager. We were so busy keeping our youth ministry together that we failed to connect Johnny with normal Christian adults. And again, I'll say it again, youth leaders are typically not normal adults. We failed to connect him with normal Christian adults who followed God with a passion. I'm not suggesting that the style of our youth ministry is the single most significant cause of Johnny's spiritual condition today. I think his family had a lot to do with that. But I do know that although we provided for many of his felt needs, we failed to address the single need for continuity. Recent studies are suggesting that teenagers may be much more open to experiences with their parents and by association with other adults than has been commonly believed. As a matter of fact, the first issue of the Journal of Research on Adolescence dispelled the myth that healthy adolescence requires a strong break with parents. Here are some of their surprising conclusions. Number one, equating the youth years with inevitable storminess is inaccurate. You remember, one of the reasons we moved into the model of youth ministry we're in today is growing out of, I guess it was John Dewey's philosophy, that these years of adolescence are years of crisis, and we've got to separate the years of crisis from children and from adults. And let's educate them in a secondary education. Let's put them in a completely isolated setting by themselves. But according to this most recent research, equating youth years with inevitable storminess is inaccurate. Number two, the predictable disintegration of parent-teen relationships through conflicts is also false. All the naysayers who say, just watch out till your kids are teenagers, it's going to be miserable. The most consistent message here in this research is, in fact, that message is false. That the disintegration of the family relationship between parents and teens actually does not happen across the board in the way we once assumed it did. And three, teenagers are more likely to support parental values than to be in conflict with them. I think that data is startling, and it's information that we need to hear and be encouraged about, particularly when parents have gotten the message that I know this kid is going to reject all of my values when he gets into high school. It's simply not consistent with the data available. Because the current of traditional youth ministry has been so heavily weighted on the individuation side of the balancing act, the majority of this course and the majority of my philosophy emphasizes the need for continuity. But on the other side of that tightrope is a teenager's need for owning their own faith, for separating, for pushing against the tradition that's been given them. And so the remainder of this lecture, we're going to focus on that need. Without that balance, a myopic emphasis on one need against the other can actually create rather than solve youth ministry problems. A new program overemphasizing continuity will be no more effective than the old one overemphasizing individuation. The fall is simply on the other side of the tightrope. So let's talk a bit about this need for individuation. Several years ago, I took a group of teenagers to Frontier Ranch, a Young Life property in Colorado. And on the third day, right after breakfast, we were assigned to the ropes course, complete with zip line and high wire. By the time I made it to the end of the course, I knew I had a problem. I was still 25 feet in the air, and there was no logical way down. I couldn't go back. The two rugged freshman girls behind me would have laughed. And then I saw it. Dangling in front of me, just out of reach, was a trapeze. Now, I had read enough of those How to Build Community by Scaring the Wits Out of Kids books to know what was coming next. I was supposed to jump to the trapeze and trust that the sophomore boy holding the rope would not try to seek revenge for the wet willy I'd given him that morning. If you aren't familiar with that term, wet willy, ask one of the youth in your church to demonstrate it for you. The instructor shouted up the simple directions, "Jump to the bar. It's the only way down." Well, as a Christian, I decided it was my duty to let the girls behind me go first. At one at a time, they went. The girls leaped with no apparent concern for their bodies. I was less than eager to let go of my solid footing. There was no way to reach the trapeze and stand securely at the same time. Eventually, I did jump, caught the bar, and was lowered to the ground without incident. As I look back on that time, I think, what a marvelous picture of adolescence. These are the jumping-off years. Some are going to make the jump out of the security of childhood with relative ease. For others, it's a terrifying step. Safety harnesses should be required equipment for everyone. Safety harnesses could be families and the extended family of the church. I can't think of any other that would be a safety harness to carry them. The creator of the developmental process intentionally designed adolescents so that they would not be satisfied simply living as appendages to their parents. The story of Edsel Ford, the son of Henry Ford, is a classic example of the innate need children have to separate from their parents. The story of the life of Edsel Ford is replete with examples of how Edsel was thwarted in his attempts to individuate. Those are my words, adding individuate. Turning finally to the world of modern art, something his father knew little about, as a way of distinguishing his life from that of his famous father. The need was so strong that Edsel continued to spend a great deal of his energies fostering modern artists, even though the elder Ford scoffed at his endeavors, maintaining that Edsel needed nothing more than the chance to follow in his father's automaking footsteps. As Eric Erickson and David Elkind and others have argued, the primary developmental task of adolescence is the formation of a personal identity. These wet cement years give us the most teachable moments for helping young people establish their own faith identities. These are the passionate years when teenagers try on different beliefs, like they might try on clothes at a department store. There's nothing healthy about teaching our teenagers simply to parrot back what we believe. If they're going to honestly embrace the Christian faith, they need to make intentional decisions about what they believe. I'm particularly grateful for parachurch groups like Young Life and Campus Christ, Campus Life and Fellowship of Christian Athletes, because they've consistently provided outlets for teenagers to express their own faith apart from the faith of their parents. Because these groups are seldom linked to a specific church, and very few parents actually force their children to go to these groups by attending, young people are often saying, "Hey, this is what I believe." As a high schooler, I was enthusiastically involved in a marvelous Young Life club. In my idealism, I expressed great frustration over the deadness of my own church, of course, compared to the excitement of the Young Life meeting. There was even a time when I talked with my Young Life leader about starting our own church, because there really were, in my estimation, no churches in town that seemed to really understand what it meant to be a Christian. Our wise leader, who was himself active in a local church, advised against it. At least part of my frustration with my church grew out of the passion of my growing relationship with Christ. Wisely, my dead church minister affirmed my growth and involvement in Young Life. And his lack of defensiveness allowed me both to individuate and to maintain the necessary continuity with an extended Christian family of the church. Eugene Peterson's explanation matches my own experience. He says, "Resistance to the church isn't the first step to atheism. It's more likely to be a natural development in discipleship." The fact that some teachers, teenagers seem to go along with everything their parents and youth leaders believe may be less a sign of maturity and more a sign of avoiding the challenges of growing up. Kevin Huggins points us beyond the pseudo-maturity of many young people when he explains, too often the teens who find church attractive are the compliant, compulsive kids who possess the iron will to keep the rules that are given to them in the name of God. This is a tragic irony, since the very thing that is supposed to be generating soul dependence on Christ is really strengthening a kid's dependence on himself. Now, I think we can agree that the stepping away, this individuation, is necessary. Owning our own faith, in John Westerhoff's words, is a necessary, primary, crucial, essential component of growing in Christ. But there are hazards to individuation. Often the process of individuation is very uncomfortable for the keepers of the faith, the parents and the churches. Some teenagers arrive at their own convictions only through a process of rejecting what they have been taught. Admittedly, much of this adolescent criticism and anger is immature, but for some it is a necessary step. If teenagers do not care enough about their faith to question their parents or their church's belief, their faith will remain underdeveloped. C.S. Lewis makes this same argument in his book Miracles. Many a man brought up in the glib profession of some shallow form of Christianity, who comes through reading astronomy to realize for the first time how majestically indifferent most reality is to man, and who perhaps abandons his religion on that account, may at that moment be having his first genuinely Christian experience. And again, in Mere Christianity, he argues, when a man who's been going to church in a routine way honestly realizes that he does not believe in Christianity and stops going, provided he does for honesty's sake and not just to annoy his parents, the Spirit of Christ is probably nearer him than it ever was before. This dynamic poses a special predicament for the youth worker. It is possible that as we are successful in our work of moving youth toward mature Christian adulthood, we may very well find our youth becoming more critical of the church than before because they care more. And the process can be unnerving. When I was a student at Baylor University, where I'm told there are more Southern Baptists than there are people, I was at the height of my own spiritual individuation process. Everything was an issue worth arguing about. As I look back, I'm amazed at how easily I could determine who was and who was not a Christian on campus. You know, as a matter of fact, I had trouble finding even one Christian teacher at that Baptist school. As an older adolescent, I was able to know and affirm what I believe partly by clarifying who did and who did not believe like I did. Now, at worst, this move toward individuation can become a judgmental us-versus-them battleground in which every issue is a witch hunt worth burning someone for. But at its best, this experience can be a healthy part of establishing one's own faith. This process is not mature Christian adulthood, but it's often a necessary step along the way. When I was clear in my judgment of every professor on that campus as not being a Christian, that was not mature Christian adulthood, but it was a step in this journey along the way. Jesus' methods for teaching his disciples addressed both their need for continuity and their need for individuation. Jesus did much of his teaching in the context of the religious establishment, and he quoted often from the scripture of the Hebrew tradition. But Jesus didn't teach his disciples by giving them answers that they could memorize. He taught them by raising questions that would engage them more deeply in their pursuit of God. If we hope for our teenagers to grow toward mature Christian adulthood, we must stop programming in such a way that we exclude our best students, those who stay away from the church because they care about their faith experience enough to question what they've been told. What is needed is a ministry that touches every teenager we are responsible for, whether or not they ever darken the doorway of our church. This kind of ministry will focus less on programming again and more on intentionally helping young people build connections with mature Christian adults in the church. So how do we create opportunities for individuation? Our youth ministries can encourage and support the process in several ways. To begin with, more of our programs can be designed for the youth themselves to serve and lead. Giving real responsibility is the doorway into the world of adulthood. Research consistently indicates that when older youth tutor young people, the tutors gain more from the experience than they give. The same is true in peer counseling programs. It is evident that when young people feel significant and needed, they tend to drop in their delinquent behavior. Recently, I had a mother explain to me that her son was unhappy because he was, quote, not learning anything in Sunday school. When students and parents have complained about Sunday school in the past, my typical response was to run to that Sunday school teacher and try to fix the class, either by getting a new teacher or teaching the class myself or devising a new curriculum. But all of those solutions met with limited success. By taking entire responsibility for the solution, I was part of the problem. I failed to realize that my over-functioning solutions created the dissatisfaction in the first place. So instead of trying to reinvent Sunday school programs to keep this boy happy, I decided to offer him a position teaching alongside adults in a children's class. Most churches have experienced the mass exodus of 11th and 12th graders from their youth groups. By the time teenagers are 16 or 17, they'll make one of two choices regarding the church. Either they'll become increasingly invested, or they'll drop out. Older youth in general will not continue being involved as spectators, regardless of how exciting the programs may be. In an age when teenagers are virtually unnecessary for the efficient functioning of society and of the church, we can intentionally create opportunities for older teenagers to be needed. Again, this is why mission trips are so key, plugging the kids into other relationships. What we have found, when I wrote Family-Based Youth Ministry, we were at a time where we had, four or five active kids in general that would graduate each year. You know, we had good connections with another 15 or 20, but only four or five were active. This year, we just had our graduation party, our senior banquet, a couple nights ago. And we had probably 25 kids there. This group's been consistently, probably 20 of them have been active all year long. And I do believe that one of the keys is we began Family-Based Youth Ministry intentionally in a focused way when this group was in the seventh grade. And we said to their parents, here's what we want you to do. And every year, this class had been involved with this group of parents. So, again, this is a little side note, but even more than giving them leadership opportunities is the need, if they have these significant connections with this extended family, if they feel like they belong, they'll keep coming back to dinner. They'll keep coming to the family table every week. Again, the other thing that we had in that class that seemed to be significant is that we had the continuity of a single couple that taught a single couple? Is that an oxymoron? They taught for the entire 6 years from the time they started in seventh grade all the way until they're now graduating. That sort of continuity had incredible power for their involvement. So I want to say that I have, you know, one of the things that I've learned since the writing of Family-Based Youth Ministry is that sort of these primary emphases on empowering the family and making the connection with the extended family, those really are the strongest predictors of whether kids are going to be involved into their older high school years. Even more so than what I'm about to talk about, though I'm certainly believing that it's important to have kids involved in leadership. But first, I think we've got to make these primary connections even more than these things I'll talk about now. A second way we can encourage our teenagers' process of individuation. The first way, of course, is giving them opportunities for leadership. The second way is to support their expressions of moving away. The parents I respect most have made their children's church attendance a non-negotiable, but then given their children the choice of what church they'd like to attend. I've often said that some of our most mature teenagers now go to went to other churches. Mary Price, who I described in a couple lectures ago, she spent most of her years going to a different church. that pulling away was a key part of her individuation process. So she had the continuity of the extended family here that stayed connected to her, as well as the opportunity to stretch and own her own faith in another context. I have to swallow my pride and give up my expectation that our program should be able to meet every young person's need. But as startling as it sounds, without exception, I would have to say that our teenagers who have been active in other churches have gained more than they have missed and have grown in their faith. By stepping away and going to somebody else's church on their own, taking the initiative, they have gained more than they would have gained here. I take the same attitude toward our children's involvement in Bible studies at school or Christian summer camps. Though their involvement in these groups may limit the amount of time they have for our youth group, this broader experience meets a specific need for our teenagers that exclusive involvement in our church cannot meet by itself. I've described my pastor in high school a number of times. George understood my need to participate in a variety of groups and infer my involvement in young life, even though the leaders were much more conservative than he was. He asked questions and wanted to hear about my experiences, even if he couldn't agree with all the theological conclusions I was making. A third way we can support this process is by creating multiple mentoring opportunities for all the teenagers in our church. Peter Benson's first recommendation to schools is easily transferable to church settings. He advocates that schools become, quote, more personalized so that each and every child feels cared for, supported, and important. The whole homeschool movement phenomenon over the last few years really has grown out of the incredible power that comes when a child gets exclusive attention educationally. And what they found is, and what we found educating our son in his junior high years at home, is that academically you simply cannot beat the attention and the focus on that child's particular weaknesses or strengths or needs or particular bent. And so the whole idea of schools or churches finding ways to help every child feel cared for and important is significant. There are many young people in my church who have made the choice not to participate in our programs. But there are very few who would refuse an invitation to have lunch with me or with one of the youth staff. By providing mentors, or it may be an overstatement, by providing connections or support for our youth, we provide the extended family for our teenagers, whether they ever attend a youth event or not. Now, I think particularly of a young woman who I visited when she was in high school. She would never come to our group. Her mother always tried to make her come, and she would never come. And then she went off to college and has sort of a very distant, I'm not sure I believe in God kind of attitude. But she, every time she would come back in town, she would come and find me. We'd go to lunch, and now she has moved back in town, and we get together on a semi-regular basis just to connect. And you know what? On Sunday mornings, we're finding her beginning to come in church as she moves into her late 20s. She even though during those years we were a failure with her getting her to come to our meetings, but over the years having the continuity of a relationship with a pastor or with someone else in the church has had incredible power. Okay, one final way to provide opportunities for teenagers to individuate is to plan for significant peer experiences for teenagers within the church. Now, that's what most traditional youth ministries do well. But without the foundational connection to mature Christian adults, this sort of peer-centered ministry can be no more than short-term, flash-in-the-pan experiences with no lasting impact. But with a proper foundation, teenagers can help each other significantly on the journey toward independence. Adolescence involves letting go of the security that comes with dependence on parents. But teenagers are not fully prepared to be independent either. They need a handrail. They need something to hold on to until they can become truly independent. Because teenagers are looking for a family to which to give their loyalty, peers become a temporary family of sorts. And in the short term, can exert even more influence on their values than their parents do. There is nothing wrong with using positive peer pressure as a doorway into the church's program. Family-based youth ministry is not about abandoning all traditional forms of youth programming as much as it is about building a foundation of solid connection with mature Christian adults. Okay, as we wrap up this lecture, a few implications for ministry. One, we can expect that as young people grow toward Christian maturity, some of them may very well go through a time of rejecting at least parts of the faith of their families before they can embrace it for themselves. If the church is prepared for this kind of response, they can, in a non-anxious way, continue to love and celebrate God's work in young people who find themselves moving away from the faith they've received. Number two, the natural adolescent desire for separation from the world of adults is a healthy, natural process. What is not healthy or natural is the neglect of teenagers by adults, the assuming that because teenagers want to pull away, they need to be left alone. We must not use the God-ordained process of identity formation as an excuse for the wholesale abandonment of our responsibility for the ongoing nurture of the next generation. Number three, youth programs that emphasize student leadership without connecting those teenagers to an ongoing community of faith deprive the young people of the very relationships that can most effectively lead them to Christian maturity. But undergirded by Christian families and the extended family of the church, those same students, those same student leadership programs can greatly enhance a young person's growth in Christ. Number four, many churches can easily hire an active senior to work 5 hours a week as an intern for the youth program. And here's a wild hair. Cancel all your youth activities. That always seems to be the best wild hair. Cancel all the youth activities for a month and allow each teenager in the group to find a ministry where he or she can serve in the church during that month. Report back at the end of the month and share the ministry experiences. As we wrap up this discussion of walking the tightrope and young people's need for individuation, I want to give you a little hint at what's coming next as you fast forward the tape and flip it over. We're going to talk about youth culture. There's a lot of fascination about where youth culture is. My experience is it's pretty hard to get your finger on the pulse of youth culture, but because as soon as you read something that's been written, whatever it was that was the trend they were watching has now morphed into something different. We're going to talk about youth culture and talk about the dangers of absorbing the values of youth culture into the church. And we'll talk about three major currents there. So if you'll fast forward the tape to the end and flip it over, we'll move to that lecture.